It's not that I want to attack all these people, but if you don't do that, you get external critics. And they are in the mainstream media, and they will invent stuff. And they will say like, oh yeah, Bitcoin art is melting the North Pole or whatever. So if you want to have good critics, then they have to come from internally, that you at least know a bit where you're talking about.
Kim DeVos writes and talks about Bitcoin. He formerly hosted Owls for Bitcoin, the independent ad-free voice of Belgian Bitcoiners. Kim, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thanks for having me, Cody.
Now, I had come across some of your articles previously, including Bitcoin books are a sham, you probably don't need a hardware wallet, orange pilling has become a mental issue, Bitcoin conferences drink your milkshake. These titles may upset some people, but really what you are writing about is pretty eloquent, describing the changes in the Bitcoin world over the last few years, and in particular some of the grift and hype and tribalism that has emerged over recent years. What has happened, Kim?
Well, as many Bitcoiners, I've started a podcast. So they either write a book or start a podcast, as you know. But it's all to help the community. So, along the way, you go to conferences or you go to local meetups and you try to, talk to the people and help Bitcoin forward, help the community forward. And along the way, you see, and this is natural, of course, see some, let's say, disadvantages or things we should overcome. And what happened is that I realized that if you start to criticize that in private, almost everyone agrees with you. But if you start to criticize that openly, then you have, not a lot of problems, but it's like a bit of backlash. And people are afraid sometimes, certainly from companies within the Bitcoin space, to talk about it because they are afraid to lose business or afraid to lose sales on a book or whatever. So, and I understand that. If I have, a company that sells hardware wallets, I cannot say anything just that I think, because maybe it will hit my sales. So I started this series of 12 articles. I'm in article 9 now. And there are a few more coming to criticize that on purpose, because usually the criticism comes from people like Peter Schiff or outside of the Bitcoin world or like coiners who, don't always think so fond of Bitcoin for other reasons, because they want to sell you their token or their stuff. So that's what happened. And I started to write about that because these are real problems that we need to either overcome or realize that they are there.
Yeah. No, it really struck me. I actually came across them via Stacking News. Someone was sharing them there. It might have been you. And there was a certain critique within those articles that really struck me because, I set out on this journey to kind of actually understand what's going on, Kim. Yeah. And in a sense, there is this pursuit of truth and really trying to get to the root of things that I think comes through in Bitcoin, verify, don't trust, these kinds of mm-hmm. things, these shibboleths that we've developed. But as you say, over the years, maybe there's certain narratives that are difficult to criticize. And also the idea that maybe Bitcoin isn't a monolithic group of people. There's actually a lot of internal, I wouldn't call it factions, but certainly internal perspectives. And I personally think the tension between those is healthy. But perhaps as Bitcoin becomes more mainstream, one narrative dominates potentially.
Yeah, this I think there are two bigger groups from the conferences and the local meetups I've visited. That's just my conclusion. There are some the grassroots movement, let's call it. People who are really there to say like, okay, run your own node, self-custody, and try to pay each other in Bitcoin if possible, and thriving that local economy. And then there are like all the others. So, and not saying that those grassroots people are always the good guys or the bad guys. There are no good and bad guys in Bitcoin. It's just math and the hardest money in the world. And that's the discrepancy. Like, we have the hardest money in the world, and then you see people at the conference trying to hawk you to get their middleman stuff in to get $3 referral link stuff or whatever. And I think this is not the ethos, dudes. But that disturbs me a bit because some people lost the plot along the way and are like serving, let's say, bigger middlemen. And for example, in the books and in the job section within Bitcoin, I see a lot of fake. And mind you, this gets drawn in together with people who are genuinely writing good books and genuinely offer really cool Bitcoin jobs. But the amount of noise in the space is enormous. And that's maybe why these factions have these fights or inner visions that differ so much, because some people are looking at the core of Bitcoin and have that as their life goal almost, or religion or whatever you want to call it. And on the other hand, are there people like, yeah, if I get paid this week, it's okay for me. So, and not saying it's good or bad, it's just what it is. And if you stand at a conference, and that one anecdote that I tell, like, and someone comes to me and said, oh, what do you sell? It's like something's wrong then.
Yeah. Well, I reflect on this myself, Kim. You know, Bitcoin has been very good to me, and, you know, I'm relatively new to it, I must admit, and it's only been a few years, but I've met a lot of people along the way. But really, for me, it's been this entrance into learning more about philosophy, economics, political economy, these kinds of topics, which I'd always had an interest in. And in a sense, it has changed my life. But at the same time, as you say, if you're not careful, this thing can take over your life. And I think there's a bigger question here around maybe man's search for meaning and belonging and these kinds of things. But it seems as if there is a lack of... If you're critical of some of the core narratives, it gets right to the core of people, and it can be quite disruptive. But really, we need to be able to ask these questions in a Socratic way. And so you mentioned some Bitcoin literature, the Bitcoin books are a sham. And, you know, really, you say here, Bitcoin literature needs to evolve. The market is flooded with inbred ideas. And I thought this was a really interesting take because, yeah, it seems like every day there's a new Bitcoin book coming out, kind of saying the same thing. And where is the actual innovation in that thinking? Because I don't know, man, it seems like everyone's trying to read from the same song sheet. But actually, you know, there are some bigger questions, right?
There are bigger questions indeed. And also, especially about Bitcoin podcasts even and Bitcoin books. But how many times can you tell that Bitcoin is hard money and that fiat is, let's say, bad or has a lot of disadvantages? We've seen that in the Bitcoin standard. We've seen that in Broken Money. We've seen that in a lot of other books. That's cool. And really cool books and so on. And then you see time and time again people telling the same story or trying to push their product. And then I think, okay, for example, I had a small idea for something, a niche subject within Bitcoin. It went about time management and so on, which is something that I really like. And I pivoted this to one of the Bitcoin book people. And it was okay. But then you get into the insights of how that industry works. And it was, let's say, disappointing. And not to say that these guys are doing bad work, but because they're not much of them, but it's so, let's say, all amateuristic and low level. If you compare it to other industries like the telecom industry, it's really in its infancy, and we don't need to shoot it, of course, because we're all Bitcoiners, we want it to thrive. But we really need to see that we need to grow and get a little bit more organized and professional. And that's why I write these things. The Bitcoin jobs, for example, is absolutely horror. If I talk to people, if I can go on a rant about that, but I talk to people that are really working in coding, for example, and developers that are really working with these companies, they either don't get paid, they either get other drama, which is totally not necessary, and no stability at all. And it cannot be that difficult to get a company that makes a nice product and have people have an income and do something with that. Certainly when some people sit on $40 billion of Bitcoin, I don't get that. Why are they grifting, and why are they scraping together every $100 to get the developers to do something? It's mind-boggling, actually.
Well, you wrote something which made me chuckle, which was that a beggar outside Brussels central train station with a McDonald's cup makes more money than a lot of Bitcoin contributors. And that really struck me as this idea that, you know, there's a lot of free and open source ethos within Bitcoin. But at the same time, and I would like to get your opinion on this, but I feel as if there's not really any surface area, in a sense, when you take Bitcoin to its core, there is no middleman in that system. And so to try and scaffold a business or a service in between, except potentially for fiat integration, pure Bitcoin plays necessarily tend towards zero. And so it's a very precarious place to be. So the idea there's no surface area for businesses, what are your thoughts on that?
First of all, if there are venture capitalists investing in Bitcoin, making, for example, an app that combines a few functions and acts as an on and off ramp, and they can pay like 12 people working there, developers and so on, marketeers, then that money comes from the venture capitalists from the fiat world. So you either get that form of inflow of money, and they hope to make their money back because the price of Bitcoin goes up over time, and they can make their money that way, and they can establish themselves in the market. But almost all other forms, I don't see it happen in the way it is now, because people don't see the value for value proposition as it should. So that is totally broken. If they don't like something, they will not contribute. I see that for myself. If you say something or you block something that they don't like, they will not contribute. They don't see that contribution, if you don't like the opinion, is meaningful and has value. And I'm at fault there as well. I will not contribute to someone's opinion that I really hate, saying, oh, this was really helpful for the community, but I hate his guts, so I will donate some sats. It's a bit anti our nature, but it's the reality. So you write something that's maybe, or you do something that's maybe helpful, but you don't get an income. So what does bring you income is, let's say licking the heels of the big ones and say hardware wallet XYZ, which I know is not good, is really good. You have to buy it. Here is my referral link. So then you become a grifter and a problem, in my opinion. But you don't have much choice, because if you don't do that, I saw it with my own podcast. If you don't do that and you have no sponsors, no ads, no income, then you do it for free as a hobby for the community. And that ends at some point because you get other interests and so on. So I don't see a solution for that, to answer your question, because the businesses themselves need to think about how can we get, working funds in, maybe yield. And that's, of course, a dangerous word to say in Bitcoin, because if you speak yield, you are immediately shifted towards something else.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I mean, there's a lot there. So a couple of things. So number one, I think there's something about the free and open source and that kind of base level, the technology of it, that something about that has managed to maintain those ethoses that started off in the beginning, putting this out to the world. And I think that's very important. But what we're starting to see is, as you've described, this connection between big business and the free and open source world. And I think the moment where this came out for most people was, it was the block size wars and this kind of collective trauma, that even though that was before my time, everyone sort of talks about it as this kind of moment when, we can't let big business ever really get a say in Bitcoin. And perhaps that, I'd like to hear what you think, but maybe there's a legacy there of that kind of anti-bank, anti-big business involvement. But at the same time, the reality is for it to work as money, people need to be able to use it. And people who don't necessarily believe in it need to be able to use it. And well, that what I've just said might also be a narrative that we need to critique. You know, is it actually only going to be for people who want to be outside of the system, as opposed to people, you know, everyday people, for example? Like, I mean, there's this whole idea of hyper Bitcoinization, right? And I sometimes wonder, you know, what does that actually mean? Is that what actually happens, or is it that people like you and I use it to be outside of their existing power structures, but most people don't? And so there's a few topics there, but I wanted to throw that at you and get your thoughts, please.
First of all, I think there's a split there that is organized or almost caused by the big players here. If they systematically don't or almost don't support the free and open source world, let's say, to generalize it a bit, then they choose to be the middleman and choose to be that power horse. And then we end up with the Bitcoin standard soft way, where you have fiat on top of Bitcoin as underpinning layer instead of gold back in the 70s and before. That's where we're headed right now, as far as I can see it. And that comes because of they don't support the real community. If someone makes, let's say, an app for blind people to look something up or have a wallet or whatever, it's a useful app. But if you're developing that, you will probably be on your own. Maybe you get a grant from someone who will throw you in some $500 or whatever, but that's it. So you know that you do with open source and you get applauded like, oh, you're a really good guy. You make something useful. And those big businesses don't care about that. They see like, okay, how many hedge funds can we get into our stock? So, and that's already happened. So that split already happened. And if you're stuck in that, let's say, grassroots open source movement, you also get to deal with grifters and the lots, but also with really good people who also fund things on their own. But in general, you've lost against the big money that's taken over, actually. So if you ask me, I don't see that turning back anytime soon, unless some second and third Michael Saylor level people step in that have another ethos.
Yeah, you've got some criticisms of Saylor as well, which are interesting. Yeah. But just coming back to that, so I guess what I'm getting at, Kim, is there is maybe this ideology of the moment where there is hyper-Bitcoinization is talked about and it's kind of prophesized. But I do come back to this idea that maybe it doesn't happen that way. And I'll give you an example. So my sort of social circle is at the middle of a lot of different, very interesting people. And just last week I met with an Italian central banker here in Tokyo, and we had a conversation. And I engage with these kinds of people from time to time, and I like to find out what they think about Bitcoin. And whenever I am kind of into that world of those kinds of people, and I realize, man, the power structures and the absolute network effect of the fiat system is just so huge, so powerful, that really, you know, we've got our work cut out for us. And the way Bitcoin fits into that as money, as an economy, is really interesting, because when you look at what an economy is, it is actually the productive economy. It's capital, it's factories, it's being able to make stuff. When you go to a Bitcoin conference, what is for sale is mining machines, maybe some hardware wallets, maybe some t-shirts. But there's still, to this day, there's no supply chain that's priced in Bitcoin. There's no raw materials that are priced in Bitcoin. There's no mandate for Bitcoin to pay taxes in Bitcoin to kind of create that flywheel. In this case, it's something totally outside of that system. So, sorry, there's a lot of information there, The kind of the way that all fits together, because again, I don't know if you get anything in the real economy just by pricing dollars in Bitcoin, for example. No, by pricing Bitcoin in dollars. Sorry, yeah.
That will be the fake hyper Bitcoinization, and I don't think that will work in the long run anyway, because everything is trust, of course, even if it's Bitcoin, dollar, or whatever. And I'm in Europe, so our trust in the euro, for example, is not like increasing at the moment. I speak for myself and my entourage, of course. Maybe in general there are people really keen on the euro, but no, in general you're right. The bigger companies, the banking system, I don't understand that they don't get involved that much in Bitcoin. They do, but on an international level, but not that much. And I don't understand that, because they are under attack as well of all these nation states and all these unions pushing their narrative and their central banking view and even CBDCs. If I was a big banker, I would be worried about that, and I would be involved in Bitcoin, of course. But maybe they don't see hard money, or they do it in private, because the people you talk to in private, it's always a different story. So if the hyper-Bitcoinization ever happens, then it will be that all these people have such a big percentage of the population in private that it begins to have a network effect. But I don't see it happen from the business side at the moment. As you say, on a conference, at a conference, you see indeed those things being sold. It's what I call on the lower level. No one says like, okay, we have a supply chain in Bitcoin, or we have like 10 suppliers and manufacturers that are accepting Bitcoin for whatever goods, even if it's eggs or wood or whatever.
Well, so getting to this, and again, both of us are, I think, critiquing the situation. I mean, by all accounts, you know, we want to see this thing win, but we need to also be quite honest with ourselves. And this issue of the supply chain comes back to some core fundamentals around the way economies emerge, questions of the state, you know, because there is an argument that the modern economy is only possible because of the state. And that's a pretty controversial thing to say. But, you know, I think that's something that's worth exploring. It's like, well, you know, what does that actually mean? You know, where did this come from? The ability to secure highways and transport routes and things, you know, arguably, is that how capital manifested itself? And these kinds of questions. And there's no military or state force behind Bitcoin. It's only cryptography. So it's a very different beast. And I tend to believe that goes a lot deeper, and that actually changes the role of the state in our lives. But in the sort of short to medium term, it's kind of like bolting it on, attaching it to the existing state-based fiat system. It's sort of like it doesn't compute. And it's like, yeah, the faster horse kind of idea. And so I'm just sort of, I mean, I get philosophical and I wonder, well, you know, maybe we go through some great reset, some great crisis, and there's this kind of emergence of Bitcoin over the medium to longer term. But in the short term, if it is priced in US dollars and it's used as an ETF and it's held and not used as currency, you know, what does that mean? Does that lead to capture? What does capture even mean? What is the actual threat presented, etc.? Sorry.
Yeah, I think you have like fiat cycles, like I think we're in that last part of such a cycle, and then we can have a chance of hyper Bitcoinization, or whatever you want to call it, like more adoption for real persons. But then you have two problems. But I'm going to explain that first. If you see historically, I did a few presentations because my background is more on history. Like they invent new fiat, then they want to always instigate trust in that fiat, like saying in old ages, like, oh, the emperor or the king vouches for this sort of new coin, and then everybody trusts it because it's like, well, the king says it's okay, so we do it. So it would be the same if all of Europe would say, like, oh, we switch from euro to euro 2, and it's all new bills, and this is now by force the new currency, and everybody would trust it because, yeah, it's Europe that says it, that it's worth something. So it's all trust. And then they start to print, then they start, what we all know from the many books, the fiat game, and then you end up with social unrest and captivating and capturing the economic value and the time of the people. You get unrest, and then the solution is usually some disturbance, maybe a war, maybe a takeover, maybe a revolution, whatever form, and then they invent new fiat. Because instigating trust is going away with the old way and say, oh, the euro 2 was a disaster, now we have the euro 3. and a new emperor will give it out and print it, and you will have trust again. So that's in very short how these NIDPI cycles work, a new fiat instigating trust, debt, and so on. So you have the problem that you need to onboard those people into that new trust if you want Bitcoin to take part of that. You can't stop that cycle. And you can say, stop the fiat cycle, because they will reinvent fiat every 20 to 80 years anyway. They've been doing that for like a millennia or two. And we can stop it because we have finally the hardest money. And then the discrepancy comes, and that's why I feel so bad. Then you come at a local meetup or a conference and someone is saying like, oh, I put a Bitcoin sticker on a lantern post outside and it's all good. Yeah, but that's not the way to do it, I think. So it's like the discrepancy between the challenges philosophically and the work that needs to be done to get there, the enormous amount of work, like people taking risk, people taking matter in own hands and getting to work with Bitcoin companies, putting their own fiat on the line and so on to start all that. And then you see like the absolute stupidity sometimes at local level, where you see people like saying like, yeah, I put a sticker somewhere and it's good. I did something for Bitcoin. It's like, yeah, that's nice and all, but we're not there.
Well, no, so I understand. So pulling on that thread, so this idea of fiat cycles. So I'm very interested in this because I'm also I study history, and you know, if you look at the history of money, I think it might be a personality thing, it might be just a percentage of the population, but there's people who are asking questions, and I've always asked questions, and even people like the founding fathers in the US knew the issues with money, and they were very clear about it.
Yeah.
People like Thomas Jefferson. But then there's all of the actual people and the population who, for better or for worse, go along with what is happening. And I think this comes back to trust. And this is where I begin to wonder whether Bitcoin exists outside of the fiat cycles, which will continue to happen. And we're seeing one happen right now, which is the move from fiat to CBDC fiat, maybe led by the US dollar and things like Tether. Like that's happening right now, and it's already underway. And so you kind of have your choice. You either use the stable coins, the CBDC, or you use Bitcoin. And most people are going to use the CBDC. That's clear. You know, you can't help these people. You can't tell them why they're wrong.
They go for the easiest way. Yep.
They go for the easiest way, and they trust what the state says. And that really stood out for me during the years of COVID. You know, there's certain people who just defer to authority. It's genetic, I think. You know, you can't. That's just a percentage of the population.
So did you interrupt? Sorry, during those times, those kind of people, if you would have said like, oh, you have to wear a Mickey Mouse hat to be in order, then they would all walk around like that on the street. So you cannot help those people. They're done.
Yeah, you cannot. And I mean, people just need to look into the Stanford prison experiment or the history of psychology. You know, people, mass formation, people will always, the vast majority of people will follow the authority figure. And so it's certain people like us Bitcoiners who ask questions and push back. But that makes me think that, okay, if we're going to do that, we're always going to be outside of that framework. And that makes it really challenging because supply chains and economies of scale, businesses, international businesses, all of these things, they require, you know, the growth mindset, they require addressable markets, these kinds of things. And so I don't have answers here, but I'm just trying to find out, you know, what does this look like? Mm-hmm. It's an open-ended question, but.
I can answer with, because I don't have the answer to that, because that's in the future somewhere, we will see what happens. But there are some answers in the past. I'm making a presentation for a later meetup, maybe this year, about the English Civil War back in the day. And at a certain moment, the king rallies with a sort of banner. I think it's the Dragon Banner or whatever it's called, to tell, oh, I'm in trouble. Parliament is assembling an army to attack me as a king, and assemble people and help me. So he asks for help and raises a flag to signal that he needs help from the citizens, and no one is turning up. So maybe that's the effect that we will see sooner or later, that the people in power another example, like Ceausescu giving a speech in Romania and thinking that everybody loves him still and all the paid people down there are applauding. And a few hours he's dead. A few hours later he's dead. Because he still thinks like, oh, I'm really liked and the people that don't like me disappear anyway. At some level, maybe that underground movement isn't so underground anymore. I don't think I will see that day, but I have the hope because Bitcoin will not go away. So that's the core issue for me, at least for Bitcoin, is it keeps standing anyway. The math will be there. There will always be people, even if it's a few, that will run nodes. And there aren't enough of those, but okay, it grows. And sooner or later, and it can take one generation, two generations, whatever it takes. In history, we see that build up over time sometimes. We're only in this for 16 years. And let's say I count maybe 10 years for a serious market in Bitcoin. Before the very early years, it's like, come on, that was not that serious still. It was there, but it was no market. And so you have like 10 years of real history of Bitcoin in a market, in an economy, and it's growing. But we're still very early, and that's not like a mantra. It's still... So if we see to hyper-Bitcoinization or that revolt happening on its own, it's because people will lose trust in the fiat system altogether. Like working 40 years for some fiat company and seeing 20 years of that being wiped out through inflation... People see that, but they don't name it like that. They point to other things like, oh, it's the fault of our president, or it's those guys or those guys. They also have anyone to blame. The media points them towards someone to blame for that. But sooner or later, maybe people will switch to Bitcoin. And at that level, we're not there yet, of course, but at that level, some king or some union will flag, help us because we're under attack and no one will be there.
Well, something that I've reflected on, the idea of the second realm, which is kind of a libertarian concept of, a non-state space where you can undertake trade with your friends and associates outside of the view of the state. And I've got this idea, people struggle to see the state. They struggle to understand it because they can't see it. They can talk about government, but like, what is the state? This is a very philosophical question. But I actually posit that it also goes the other way, and that the state struggles to see things that are outside of the state. And so I think this, in part, explains why it's so challenging. They don't really get it. I literally talked to these central banker guys last week, and there was like, Bitcoin's too volatile, full stop. It was an off the record chat, but they don't really understand. And I think that says to me that something like the second realm, and in particular the internet, the money, Bitcoin is native to the internet. It sort of fits into a new place for a virtual economy, and I think this is really interesting because the state still has monopoly over, at the end of the day, the police can come and get you.
Yeah.
They can confiscate your factory, right? And we were talking about supply chains earlier, but arguably there are some digital supply chains that work. You can pay a freelancer or a software developer in Bitcoin. And so I wonder, just at a higher level, whether we start to see, maybe the real world is priced in Bitcoin and dollars, and the digital world, increasingly valuable, is priced in Bitcoin. Maybe there's sort of a divergence in these two worlds, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the state's control... First of all, you have the central banks that only look at the system. So they, from the people I talk to, they are clear on that. Like, their focus is the stability of their own system, talking about the states and the central banks. So indeed, they don't understand Bitcoin. They say it's too volatile, it's only used for criminals and all that stuff. And every transaction costs one swimming pool of water or whatever they come up with. Yeah. It's sometimes funny, but okay. But on the other hand, the parallel system is very, very, very small. For me here in Europe, it's dismal. It's like, for example, the city I live in is Antwerp. Not a small city, but not the biggest one either. It's just like a city of like 500,000 people or something. We have like two places where you can pay with Bitcoin. One who does it officially and one where you have to know. So it's, come on, the parallel economy is not existing yet. And then you scrape together some people like, okay, let's onboard some businesses or at least talk to them and so on. The parallel economy isn't thriving here at all. It's you don't get the people to do that work. What they do is complain about the news and sit together and talk about Bitcoin. And I'm a bit tired of that because the parallel economy needs to build up faster. And you don't see that happen. And it's not big enough yet. I think it can happen. And the libertarian idea of having no nations, I believe in that. I don't think nations need to exist in the form they are now. But that's a whole other idea. It has nothing to do with Bitcoin on itself, actually.
I think it's important that we talk about this stuff, Kim, because I mean, you're positing these, you know, these provocations that, you know, maybe, you know, we need to look closely at you know, the Bitcoin conferences and the books and what we're talking about. You know, what I guess what I'm trying to see is if there is a way forward or thought or you know, research experimentation to happen to really undertake this. As I said, you know, I wonder whether this never works really for physical supply chains. You know, maybe that's always going to be subject to the state. But for digital supply chains, and for me, and I guess for you, you know, we're able to do this conversation over the internet. We could have, you know, I could send you Bitcoin, you can send me Bitcoin. You know, the digital service economy, the information economy, you know, surely that can be paid for. You know, the cyberspace, you know, has no nation state behind it, right? And so I think that's kind of coming back to the original ideas of Bitcoin, right, is internet money. And yet that also, I think, can be used in the real world because we've got this really important piece, which is the connection between energy and Bitcoin, which I was just reflecting on today. And I thought, you know, with enough energy, you can kind of do anything. You can 3D print a cow or whatever, you know, like you just, you know, you can synthesize all sorts of things if you've got enough power, right? And it's cheap enough. And so there is something there where Bitcoin connects back into the real world. And so I don't know, I just, maybe we dollarize in real life and we Bitcoinize in our virtual lives. And eventually we also Bitcoinize in the real world, you know, at some point in the future. But I don't know, man, I'm just throwing it out there, you know, maybe. You never see the supply chains go Bitcoin only, you know?
Maybe if their prices keep collapsing, because on the other side of that, I know a few people that work in real supply chains for real factories. They have other problems because we think like, oh, Bitcoin is not thriving like it should and it should all be dominated in Bitcoin. But on the other hand, they have problems to sell their stuff at the right price to keep their business going, to keep those supply chains running in a fiat world. I don't think they are that keen on, let's say, the fiat world and its current workings at the moment. Certainly not at the moment on the short term, because with all the tariffs and all the stuff. But even separate from that sort of shenanigans, the if you have a worldwide operation to, say, let's say, ship cookies worldwide, then you have an enormous problem to get that done. You have to have the basic resources, the grains and everything you need, the sugar, but also where do you put the packages together, where do you ship it to, where is your customer? So it's an enormous achievement to get that done. And then you have to set the price. So that's why also I find the Big Mac Index so fascinating as a measuring stick. Because, yeah, they operate worldwide. Big Mac is almost everywhere exactly the same. And, yeah, you can measure some things. So I think maybe we need something like watt dollars or whatever it's called to really measure energy, resources, people that work with something and manufacture something, and not per se Bitcoin directly. underlying maybe, but that's a dangerous proposition to make because it's very close to just use fiat. The fiat is like a state saying this is your watt dollar. That's not what I say. The watt dollar is an end result of a whole series of calculations where you almost take everything that's happening in the world. And maybe someday we can do that with advanced computers, like saying, okay, this is the worldwide fiat replacement in measuring. Well,
yeah, getting a bit sci-fi, but, you know, I've just been reflecting. So I'm from New Zealand originally, but I live in Japan. And in New Zealand, we don't have Amazon. And in Japan, we have Amazon. And it's always magical to me to just click order and something arrives the next day, because it's not like that in New Zealand. You got to go to the shop, right? And I'm beginning to wonder, you know, just as a higher level concept, you know, is it possible that, you know, manufacturing as a concept is kind of finished, right? It's kind of, you know, we've got to the final state. And, you know, if to start a manufacturing operation, you need to just have cheap, scales of economy and capital already in place. Like to disrupt that industry now, you know, maybe very challenging. And so assuming that's kind of finished in a sense, which it, I don't think it has, but, you know, just as a hypothetical, again, it comes back to my argument that maybe the value to be built forward is in the virtual space now, and this, you know, maybe comes into AI and some of these new things that are happening. You know, is that the new frontier for, you know, business, and is that the new edge? And in that case, again, you know, the use of Bitcoin is already possible, and it is being used quite a lot. Energy comes into that as well. You've got data centers and all sorts of things, and so I guess you talk about the cookie and how it comes together, but I don't know. Maybe that's sort of those real world scenarios are still priced in US dollars, which, I again, coming back to this thing I was at last week, it was on the decline of the dollar, and these legacy economists were basically debating what the tariffs mean as kind of a weapon or economic trade warfare that is leading to higher prices for, you know, in Japan where I live, you know, if there's tariffs, that's hard for the entire supply chain for a car, for example, because the energy also is quite expensive here. So there's kind of like, I don't know, man, I'm just throwing ideas, but it just seems like maybe we end up with one winner, which maybe it's the US dollar. Maybe manufacturing as a concept is kind of in its final state. But the new battle is in the virtual world, in the second realm, where Bitcoin is native and able to be used by anyone. And maybe it just unfolds in ways that we can't imagine.
Yeah, on manufacturing, what you say, I think it's not done yet, but it's getting there, because most manufacturing in its core, so I talk about the core resources to the first product, is already in hands of like 200 people or something worldwide. So what do you have then? It's in fact a de facto plant economy. And it has this sauce over it like it's a free market. But in the end, they know, like, okay, you have to have copper, then you have to go to those three guys, and they all know each other, and they set the prices, and so on. Or you have to have anything manufactured. Maybe we move to maybe sci-fi land where we steer that globally, and I don't know, but the political impact of that will be enormous, because the traditional politics that is happening right now will be done as well. If you just say, like, okay, manufacturing is actually done worldwide, we do it that way, and we distribute everything in a more organized way. Everything is now digital, actually. Maybe there is some worldwide AI that can administer that, and then that cookie factory will be gone, or at least the brand will still exist, and you will get a cookie. But it's not like one capitalist doing that anymore.
What you just
nothing
said.
Nothing against capitalism, by the way, but just
and the fact that you have to preface that statement by saying nothing against capitalism, it's like a bit of a tribalistic thing, because, you know, I think we should criticize it, and especially the relationship with capital and fiat money. You know,
but about criticizing. Sorry to interrupt. Hmm. About criticizing. Now I come to realize this. The Bitcoin space has this problem, like, if you criticize something, you're the bad guy, or you're trying to attack someone. And that's also tribalism. Like, I deliberately play the bad guy by posting these articles. The last one against art, for example, Orange is the New Orange, where I criticize the way we see to like Bitcoin art. And it's not that I want to attack all these people, but if you don't do that, you get external critics. And they are in the mainstream media, and they will invent stuff. And they will say like, oh yeah, Bitcoin art is melting the North Pole or whatever. So if you want to have good critics, then they have to come from internally, that you at least know a bit where you're talking about.
Yeah, and this is why, I mean, as I said, I went to these events, and I'm talking to these people, and I'm sitting there with, yeah, like the former deputy foreign minister of Japan behind me in this conference, mm-hmm. and I'm wearing my orange pants to the event, you know, and I'm sort of putting my hand up and asking about Bitcoin. But at the end of the day, no one is in that space who's really into Bitcoin. And I mean, globally, there's this movement to kind of talk to governments about it and kind of communicate or evangelize. But actually, like, no, I'm not here to evangelize. I just want to hang out with these guys and see what they have to say and the way they think. I want to get into their heads. What are they doing? What are they, you know, how do they see themselves in relation to the world? And certainly it feels like they think they're in control of the world, as far as I can see. But that it strikes me that what you said, this, like, you know, a small number of people in control of the core elements, right, of manufacturing. You know, is this, say, for example, that this would be a really interesting Bitcoin book, but like this 200-year cycle of the Industrial Revolution, again, like, is that kind of finished? Like, have the people got what they're going to get? And countries that missed out, say, Western Africa, they're never going to get what they what they need to become, you know, developed countries.
No, because they were robbed, yeah.
They're robbed, and that phase is finished, you know. And this is quite important, you know. I was at another event yesterday talking about Ghana and kind of its attempts to kind of develop its economy, and it's one of the more developed economies of Western Africa, but still, you know, poor. And I compare that with New Zealand, and I think, well, New Zealand made it, and it was able to get these infrastructures in place and become a successful country, but Ghana didn't really make it. And is it ever going to make it? You know, this idea that it's somehow going to bootstrap itself. It's like, no, maybe it's too late. Like, the race is over, and the winners have got their piece. And so I'm starting to think more hypothetically, where to from here, which is kind of new territory. And that's what I'm really excited about, kind of the sci-fi of it, which I think early cypherpunks were in this space. They'll think, well, yeah, you know, where could it be? But instead, we get Marcus Saylor and ETFs and banks and stuff. And it's like, oh, it's like not quite hitting where we wanted it to go, right?
No, I'm really a fan of the sci-fi writer Peter F. Hamilton. Don't know if you know him. And he jumps forward every time a few hundred or thousand years. And it's really fascinating to see how that economy works that he invented. And I think there's some truth in there. Like, you have one, like, dominating force of AIs that can, let's say, measure the real value to pay it, to exchange goods. And that's what money actually should be, like, just a measuring stick that's trustworthy to exchange. And even Bitcoin is not there yet, because we don't see it yet for what it is, because it's so early. And that's why it's a pity to see that we don't strive in that direction. Like, I'm waiting for the first real Bitcoin company. And that's a dangerous thing to say, because we have many, of course. We have, like, Blockstream, and we have Strategy, and we have all these kinds of... In fact, they are not real Bitcoin companies yet. They are using Bitcoin. They hold Bitcoin. They try to do marketing stuff and develop some apps and products. But are they really in the core helping the Bitcoin standard? I don't think so yet. Maybe it can come someday. But.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I mean, in both of those situations, I mean, the Blockstream is, I mean, it's trying to build hardware wallets. It's doing some open source stuff. I mean, they're doing a lot of great work. But it's not, in a sense, in the real economy. If anything, it's the financial economy of Bitcoin. You know, if There's this distinction between the real economy of factories and capital and the financial economy of the accounting for that stuff. And in a sense, wallets and the software and all of that stuff is the financial economy of the Bitcoin world. And actually, you know, producing stuff is the real economy of the Bitcoin world. And as we've talked about today, you know, maybe you can get a coffee somewhere, but there's no coffee beans that are priced in Bitcoin from source to consumer, or this, you know, that supply chain doesn't exist at the moment really at scale.
Yeah, or it's very small, one individual doing that or something. And so
I don't know, it just this is, again, you know, it seems like we may be a little bit pessimistic about this, but I think it's worth asking these questions. And I want to say something else as well, Kim. I wonder whether, in a roundabout way, the stuff we're seeing with the books and the conferences and the kind of 21 million, actually, you know, because I participate in that, you know, I love that stuff as much as anyone. But at the same time, maybe that is necessary to kind of keep the social tribe going, to kind of get us, you know, in the right vibe, so that we don't give up on this thing. And maybe there's, the grassroots side of it is really important to maintain, you know, because Bitcoin keeps going no matter what, you know, what I think, right? And I just, I don't know, there's this kind of interplay between the social and the kind of mathematics, and people, no matter what you do, you know, you throw yourself at the idea of Bitcoin, and, you know, Bitcoin doesn't change, you change. And so, I don't know, maybe we, at the end of the day, we just need to wear our orange trousers and have our hoodies and go to the conferences, because this thing's going to do what it's going to do, you know?
Yeah, I'm really torn about that, because after years of trying to get out there and do something, I'm really, honestly, I'm, as a person, disappointed, not in Bitcoin, but in the community. And the problem with that is, if you have a company, for example, or you have a podcast, or you have like 20 books that you want to write, if you start to complain, then you're the complainer, which is not really cool to make sales. I don't have to look at that, because I don't make sales, I don't manufacture anything, so I cannot lose customers. If they don't like me, they don't like me, I don't care. But
yeah,
many businesses don't have that luxury. So if they say, like, oh, let's say you have an artwork that you made, and you complain that no one is buying it, then you're a complainer, and you will not attract many customers by doing so. And they all know that, so they don't complain, unless it's in private. So I know some documentary maker who put really hard work in something about Bitcoin, and he complained on stage at one point at some conference a few months ago. And everybody in the audience was like, oh, he's really a complainer, he should work harder. And that came from people who do absolutely nothing. So that guy was like really having an honest discussion about, like, hey, people, I literally cannot eat this week, and I made a nice documentary for Bitcoin. So everybody enjoys the documentary, and they donate like some sats, like 2,000 sats here and there, and that's it. And the guy cannot eat that week. So next year, he will probably not make a documentary anymore. He will do some fiat job and do whatever. So people have a choice between fiat and Bitcoin. And at the moment, Bitcoin is losing for the real jobs, I mean. So if I have to do something, and I have the choice now between doing it for fiat and Bitcoin, as a Bitcoiner, I should always choose hard money, Bitcoin, in theory. In practice, I choose fiat. And that's something Bitcoin has to solve and have to recognize as a problem. But if you call that out, you're a complainer and a loser and self-serving. I was called many things. And that's a bit of a problem, because not everyone can say that. If I get a mail from someone from a well-known Bitcoin company who says, I agree totally with what you write, and I say, why don't you say it openly? It would be an enormous impact if you admit that it's like this. Oh no, I cannot do that. Okay, fine. That's a problem.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah.
No, I mean, you shut up for who? We're in Bitcoin. Yeah. You don't have to shut up for anyone.
Yeah, no, well, I'm sorry to hear that. And I guess, in a sense, Kim, what I'm humbly trying to do with this show is ask some of these questions, you know, because as I said, you know, I fly the flag, but at the same time,
me as well. Yep.
There is a reality out there that you know, I've been in the room with what would effectively be called the enemy in a sense, and these guys have power, real political power, the legacy financial system, the legacy political system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can have our conferences and our meetups, but when it comes to the true force of the state to come and get you, I don't know, a lot of people have never really felt that, especially in developed countries. Maybe COVID gave people a little bit of a kick, but the government owns you in a sense, and the state owns you, and they see you and us and our stuff as being on the balance sheet of the country. And as a Bitcoiner, ultimately you decide to opt out of that system, and it just comes with a lot of, you know, a lot of responsibility. And I think thinking about this is important, and asking questions is important. Mm-hmm. So I did want to ask you, so you mentioned when we were talking over email that you're taking a bit of a step back from the podcast, that you're going to work on some other stuff. Can you share a little bit more about that? What's sort of coming up for you? What are you looking forward to next?
Yeah, so I stopped the podcast that went, well, not offline, but I stopped producing new episodes last week or the week before. After 3 years, it was okay. The goal was to let the Belgian Bitcoiners be heard, and we did that. I interviewed a few people and so on, so that's done. Currently, I'm writing that first, the Food for Thoughts writings, which are on my website, allesforbitcoin.be. And if that's done, it's on Substack, so everybody can read it, and on Highlighter, on Noster. And then after that, well, I'm also like vibe coding a bit. Yeah, that's the new trend. I know. But useful tools for Bitcoin. And yes, they are free and they are open source, so everybody can steal them and do whatever with them that they like. One of them is a very simple tool, bip39tool.com, which is a simple tool that exchanges between words and numbers. Sometimes you need that for whatever reason, in the BIP39 list. And I also am a bit of a nerd in encryption and entropy. So I'm making a system where you have a fair distributed entropy for seed generation. The first prototype of that went offline, last week. And you can use it offline as well. So it's working well. A few people are testing it, and it's going well. So I'm doing that sort of stuff. And furthermore, I will like go back to the shadows a bit, because I realize that being in Europe, as you say, the state is quite powerful. And something crossed a red line for me. There are two instances of that. One I cannot talk about. And the second one is the subsidizing of altcoiners. So where I live in Flanders, there is a subsidy for educational platforms, and some, let's say, questionable people, let's say it, went on there and got some nice subsidies to actually promote Bitcoin for 5 minutes and then a whole series of scams for like 50 minutes or more. And that's like it for me. Like, if the state is actually supporting these kinds of people, and on the other side I'm there with my free Bitcoin podcasts that get like 2,000 sats sometimes for an episode, I'm done with that, really, after 3 years. And I'm really grateful for everyone who really supported the show and was there and sent me nice messages and all that you want. I made some nice connections and good friends there, so that's cool. But I cannot do it anymore, because on the other side there are people like, I have to tell you this. Imagine having a small area where you do a podcast only for explaining Bitcoin. And on the other side, there is a series of dudes doing the same, but for altcoins and scams and whatever. They promote the same rug pull twice. So they promote a rug pull, it gets rug pulled to their followers. And then they say, yo, it's restarted, man. You have to invest right now before it's sold out. And it's from the community now. And we're going to... And they sell it again and it gets rug pulled again. And those guys get subsidies right now from the state. You cannot win against that. It's done. So the people who are dumb enough to follow those dudes, please do so, get wrecked. They're lost. And I made the decision right then, like, I'm done with this. You cannot fight that fight anymore. It's for someone else. I don't do it anymore. And it's not only that. There are a few other things. But it's like, if you're in that sort of environment, you know that the state is actively putting money against you and against the Bitcoin ethos. It's not against me personally, but it's in general. So, no, I'm out. I will write, though. I can always write whatever I want. And if I see something good or bad happen, I will surely call it out or write some nice pieces about it, because I really like to summarize and like put it in my head, like, okay, how do I explain my stance on, let's say, Bitcoin art or books or Bitcoin jobs or whatever? And I see that many people like that, so I keep doing that.
Yeah. Well, and certainly your work resonated with me, Kim. So, yeah, thank you. Mean, a step back into the shadows, nothing wrong with that. But I guess just sort of wrapping up, I would be really interested. You've been in Bitcoin for a while and you've seen a lot of things come and go. What are some questions or ways of thinking that you've carried with you through these years that have really helped you? What has been really valuable for helping you understand what's taking place?
The core is that Bitcoin itself keeps standing there. To the many ups and downs we've seen, we saw that Bitcoin always thrives. And you have to trust that, really. And that's difficult. It's easy to say, like, yeah, Bitcoin will go up in price. It's not about the price. It's about the value. Always value Bitcoin means you know Bitcoin will be there in 1 year, in 4 years, in 15 years, in 100 years. If you really, truly believe that and know that, then you're thinking like a Bitcoiner. The fiat system cannot say that. Whatever coin they have in whatever country will probably not be there in that form in 10 years or 100 years. And if it is, it will be named that, but not have the same value anymore. With Bitcoin, the value only goes up because it's the math behind it. So central banks are theatrics and Bitcoin has mathematics. That's the main takeaway.
Yeah. Okay, that's fascinating. And that's als vor Bitcoin, always value Bitcoin, right? The phrase. That's awesome. I really appreciate your time, Kim, and talking to me about this stuff.
Thank you.
It's, as I said, it's sort of your writing struck me as asking some questions that maybe people aren't asking. And I do hope we've been clear here that it's really a provocation for others out there to come in. And if they want to write, they want to talk about the stuff and ask the questions. You know, it's quite possible that our models of the way Austrian economics from the 19th century works isn't relevant in the digital age. Maybe the nature of manufacturing and supply chains and all of our thoughts of money go out the window with Bitcoin and the internet. And we need some people creatively thinking about what this means, putting in the proof of work to explore these things and be honest with themselves and have a Socratic dialogue. I think it's truth-seeking at its core. So yeah, I really appreciate you giving me your thoughts on this, and I hope we can keep in
touch.
Thank you, certainly
it was a nice talk, and you had some nice questions as well and insights, so I'm really happily surprised. So thank you for the talk.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.